From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, education analyst Brandon Bastide of Gallup reveals why fewer Republican voters have confidence in our college system than in previous years. Then we'll rebroadcast some of our favorite conversations. Former Fox News anchor Gretchen Carlson on her latest book, Be Fierce, and playwright and star of The Walking Dead, Danai Gurria, talks about her career. But first, news icon Dan Rather has covered some of America's most significant events, including Watergate, the Vietnam War, and the September 11th terror attacks. The former CBS Evening News anchor now runs his own production company called News and Guts, and his essays on the big news stories of the day are read by millions of people online. He has also penned a book that he hopes will inspire us to talk with each other about our common values. It's called What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. Dan Rather, good to have you back on this program.
Thank you, Tavis.
Let me start with this quote that sort of arrested me. I've heard it before, of course, but I loved how you and Elliot, who worked with you on this project, put this quote at the beginning of the book. It's from de Tocqueville. And the quote is, "The greatness of America lies not in being more enlightened than any other nation, but rather in her ability to repair her faults." Do we still have that ability?
You bet we have it.
Yeah.
We have it at a depth that very few of any other people have it.
Yeah.
We're in a dark time now. We're in a very perilous time because we tend to forget it. There's so many people preaching division, trying to exploit divisions for their own partisan, political, and ideological reasons that it's easy to get caught up. Look, we have divisions. We have tremendous division among ourselves. But we have even greater number of things with more power to embolden us and to make us brave than we sometimes think. You know, inclusion, dissent, courage. This country has a lot of courage. The right to vote. Those things that bring us together. That's the reason I wanted to write What Unites Us. Because at a time, there's a tendency, particularly of younger people, you have a tremendous audience of younger people, Tavis, which is to your credit, who tend to think, well, maybe this is the worst we've ever been through. It's bad. Mm-hmm. No getting around it. In some ways, it's really heartbreaking what we're going through. But we were pretty divided in the 1960s. We were pretty divided during the high crimes, which we call for shorthand Watergate. Mm-hmm. We, of course, had a disastrous catastrophe of a civil war in the 1800s. We've been through tough times before. And if we remember who we are and what holds us together, we're going to be OK.
Let me just challenge you. I want to play devil's advocate here.
Sure.
What seems to be lacking in this current moment, which you talk about and write about beautifully in the text, is empathy. And so that's why I started by asking whether or not we still have the ability to repair our faults if we lack the empathy that's required to do that.
I think we still have the empathy. Okay. You and I may disagree. I agree that it's in very short supply. Mm-hmm. It's particularly in short supply among too many of our leaders. And let's say for what it is, let's duck it around it, particularly with our present president. There's no sign, or very little sign of any empathy, but the country at large still has great empathy and a sense of fairness. Look at what happened in the wake of Hurricane Harvey. Mm-hmm. Those people on the Texas coast and Houston, neighbor helping neighbor, regardless of race, religion, ethnicity, pulled together. They didn't wait for outside help to come. They welcomed it. But we have empathy. But one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, and empathy is my favorite chapter in the book, is to point out the difference between compassion, which is a good trait to have, and empathy, which is a stronger trait. But compassion is you feel sorry, you pity someone. And as my mother taught me at an early age, when I said something about, well, we're doing this because we feel sorry for them, she said, no, we don't pity them. We know how they feel. A spirit of, we try to walk in their shoes and in effect say, there but for the grace of God go I. That's empathy. The country still has a great deal of it, but you might never know it if you just listen to the president's tweets and what's on cable television every day.
Yeah. Since you made a distinction, and a beautiful one, Dan, between compassion and empathy, let me come at it another way. I think there's a distinction between charity and justice. And the example you gave was a beautiful example about what the country does after Harvey or after Irma or after whenever we have these natural disasters. You're right, we come together. But that's more about charity. What I see lacking in our society today is a real focus, a real interest in justice, because charity ain't justice.
No, charity is not justice. Yeah. Those are two different words. Look them up in the dictionary if you have to. Well, And justice, you know, we are committed as Americans to both the idea and the ideal of equal justice under the law. Mm-hmm. No man is above the law, but no man is above the law. Now, that's our navigational star mm-hmm. out there. We're never going to be able to achieve it with perfection, but we know down deep in our id that we can do it a whole lot better than we do it now. Mm.
See, and again, I'm pressing only because I agree with you that that is the American ideal. Right. What I'm having a hard time juxtaposing, Dan, though, are the ideals that we profess on the one hand, the IDEALS, and the ideas, the IDEAS, which are being advanced today. Back to right. your point about Trump, and it's not just the president. There are other folk who are, you know, absolutely. Right along with him. Yep. So how do you square those ideals that we profess as Americans with the ideas like this tax plan, et cetera, that we seem to be latching a hold of?
Well, let's have it out straight.
Okay.
This tax bill is ridiculous, outrageous, and really heartbreaking in many ways. There's never been a tax bill like this. This is the swamp in Washington that's come alive. Mm-hmm. This is a tax bill to benefit the wealthiest people in the country. Let's don't dance around it. Let's not try to cut it. And your point is well taken. If you say, our ideals are one thing, but our ideas are another thing. We in America, we're in an experiment to constantly get our ideals closer to ideas.
Yeah.
But we're not there. And let's talk honestly. Race is perhaps the most important talk point, conversation point, fine justice point. That we've made progress on civil rights, no question about it, but we have so far to go. Mm-hmm. So getting people to understand that, look, we have the ideal of racial justice, but we are miles away from reaching racial justice, which lives up to our ideal of equal justice under the law. Anybody who's covered law enforcement, as I have over the years, police beat, courts, knows that the justice system is badly out of balance based on color. Mm-hmm. That's a fact. It's a fact a lot of people don't want to recognize, and some people do recognize it but say, that's all right because I'm of the right color. Mm-hmm. That, I would say to you, is unpatriotic. Part of this is, mm-hmm. you know, patriotism. And patriotism, it includes recognizing we have our faults, whereas nationalism is more of a chest beating, has more arrogance mm-hmm. and conceit to it. That's the reason I want to do reflections on patriotism. I don't think we spend enough time thinking about the difference between patriotism, which is a deep love for the country, willing to die for the country, but recognizing that we're always going for that distant star, the polar star, trying to get better. Nationalism sort of takes the attitude, listen, we're the greatest in the world, beat on the chest. And nationalism, this is really important to us. Extreme nationalism, we know what that leads to. Extreme economic nationalism in the 1920s led to the Great Depression. Nationalism based on race, Aryan nationalism, led to Adolf Hitler. And we in America, that's why I say I'm wary of all this talk about nationalism. We need to talk about patriotism and ask ourselves, let's have a conversation. What is patriotism mm-hmm. here in the second decade of the 21st century?
There's a beautiful chapter in this book, a beautiful section in this book, about your covering the murder of Medgar Evers. Right. When you look back on your career covering civil rights, that and so many other incidents, right. and you see white supremacy in 2017 raising its ugly head again, the specter of it on the horizon, in the streets every day, in certain places across this country, how did you juxtapose that? What you saw then and it making a comeback in some ways in 2017?
Well, first of all, it has very strong echoes. It resonates to that time in 1960. The book in What Unites Us, one of the things that unites us is the right to vote. Mm-hmm. And Medgar Evers is one of the bravest men I have ever met of any race, color, creed, or religion. Was working very hard in and around Jackson, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. This is in the early 1960s. And I recount in the book, I went with him once to a voting place where he had people with him and said, in effect, these people are here to vote. Mm-hmm. And the white person standing on the porch, I won't repeat his language, was basically, you ain't voting here today. Mm-hmm. I never gotten that scene out of my mind. And when I hear some of the rhetoric of today, 2017, and answer your question, I say, you know, I wouldn't have thought in the 1960s that in 2017, mm-hmm. way up ahead, that we hear a president of the United States, maybe some other people, not a president of the United States, saying these things that are they're bigoted. There's no mm-hmm. other way to put it. And a president talking about equivalency between neo-Nazis, and citizens who are running a nonviolent protest. That's the reason I say this is a perilous time, because we're seeing a renewal of some of what we had in the 1960s. We thought in the 1960s, when we passed the Voting Rights Act, that that would solve the problem. It helped the problem immensely, no question about it. But here we are in 2017, we've seen all these political, what I call side dances, trying to keep people from voting, and we know what it's about. Mm-hmm. The people they don't want to vote are people of color. There's no getting around it, no denying it. So it's a reminder that while we've made some progress, we have a long, long way to go. Mm-hmm.
Given this moment that you have dissected, that we are trying to navigate our way through now, how do you personally sustain your hope?
Well, one, through the power of prayer, that I believe in prayer. It's one of those things we don't talk about publicly, and maybe it's just as well, but that's one thing. And the other is I travel around a lot. Yeah. I meet people, I talk to people, I like people, I like to talk to people. And I find I'm really encouraged when I travel the country. I took a trip with my eldest grandson this last summer. We drove from Dallas to Mount Rushmore, up to Oklahoma, Nebraska, Kansas, up into South Dakota. Everybody we met had a strong sense of decency about them. And this is Trump country, you know. And I found really encouraged. Anybody who takes such a trip and doesn't remark on the kindness and empathy of the American people has missed something very important about our country.
Maybe I need to get in my car then. Get in my car and take a trip somewhere. The new book from Dan Rather with Elliot Kirshner is called What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism, a beautiful, empowering, and inspiring read. I highly recommend it. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. According to a survey by Gallup, the number of Republican voters who have confidence in the college system has reduced significantly. Brandon Bastide is the executive director for education and workforce development at Gallup. He also conducted the survey. He joins us now to explain this trend and to discuss the implications of the political divide as part of our ongoing series on higher education. Brandon, good to have you on the program.
Thank you, Tavis.
If I read your data correctly, many Republicans, a majority in fact, now think that college may be, you tell me, is it dangerous or hazardous for America? What's the exact terminology here?
Well, so first of all, Pew Research did some great work that they released in August where they asked a question that they've been trending around overall. Are colleges, you know, more negative, more hurtful, you know, to the United States or not? Mm-hmm. And, you know, so they released that showing that 50% of Republicans say overall colleges are more hurtful to how things are going in the country, completely tanked since 2015. So this is something that's happened very recently, last 2 years. It's also not a Trump election effect necessarily.
Right.
It goes back to a lot of the issues that started to arise on college campuses in 2015, protests on campus, you know, a number of concerns and discussions about free speech and then subsequently controversial speakers on campus. And so a lot of it has revolved around that.
What is the damage that has been, or the potential damage to be done to academia?
Yeah,
to
So in the backdrop of this specific data about Republicans souring on higher ed, there's a lot going on in and around higher ed that are creating big challenges for it, right? You could just say overall, take Republican and Democrat split out of it, public perceptions of higher ed have declined.
Right.
I mean, 4 out of 10 Americans are, you know, Republican or Republican leaning, right? So if you just, you know, take that out of it, you know, there's growing questions about the ROI, the return on investment of college. That's against the backdrop of higher education tuition going up 400% since the 1980s. Mm-hmm. Americans are now shouldering $1.4 trillion worth of student loan debt. A trillion of that has been added since 2003 alone. So, you know, there's a mix of stuff going on here. It's not as simple as Republican and souring, but Gallup did follow-up research after we saw the great research that Pew had done. We asked a question about overall, how confident are you in higher education? And regardless of where you landed, we just said why, right? So if you said, I'm very confident, if you said, I'm not confident at all, we just asked an open-ended question. And it's interesting, although more Republicans are negative about higher ed than Democrats, the Democrats who are negative about it for very different reasons than why Republicans are negative. Mm-hmm. So Republicans' top reasons for being negative about higher ed are it's too liberal, don't allow students to think for themselves. That's it. That's right. Pretty much the whole story. I mean, there's more beneath that, but those are the mm-hmm. driving reasons why Republicans say they're negative. For Democrats who are negative, again, fewer negative than Republicans, their top reason is it's too expensive. Mm. Now, so if we're going to address the problems, you know, with higher ed, public perception challenges of higher ed, we're going to have to address them in different ways, right, if we think about the partisan divide. But the interesting thing on the flip side is that for those who are positive, Republicans and Democrats who are positive, they're positive for the same exact reasons. Mm. They had a positive experience with higher education. They see higher education as critical to the country and to getting good jobs.
The thing that scares me the most, and you kind of intimated this a bit earlier, is what happens to our nation when we start to think that there is no value, or when we start to think that the value of an education is not worth the effort that one has to make to attain it. That's the scary part, that we start to devalue education.
Right. Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, these are the real implications, yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. If you think about one of the, you know, the strongest economic drivers,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Higher education, post-secondary yeah. education, if we want to just give it a broader mm-hmm. context for people, because I think sometimes when we use the word college,
yeah.
right, people have this preconceived notion of a traditional 18 to 22-year-old living on a college campus. If we say post-secondary education, mm-hmm. we now start thinking about the very diverse mm-hmm. U.S. higher education system we have of community colleges,
sure.
colleges that are serving adult learners mm-hmm. right now. I mean, there's a huge mix of this, but you're already seeing some of the implications of this, right? So, you know, you look at University of Missouri, which was one of the first ones involved in some of the protests.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their enrollment right now is down 30%. They've shuttered some 10 dorms in that time frame. You know, you read articles in the local newspaper in St. Louis, and it ends with quotes from parents who are saying, I would never send my kids to the Berkeley of the Midwest,
mm-hmm.
right? Talking about the University of Missouri, right? So if we don't think this has a real impact, potentially, mm-hmm. not for all colleges, but in certain situations on enrollment, on state funding, right? When you think about Republican legislators who are, you know, trying to pay attention to what, you know, their constituents have mm-hmm. asked for, you know, there is a real challenge to this, but it goes to a whole bunch of other issues, like people saying, geez, I can't afford it anymore.
Yeah.
And if I can't go there and get a practical skill that leads to, you know, a real job outcome, well, then, you know, that's a real yeah. challenge too. So
if I can assume, if you're telling me that Mizzou is losing enrollment or decreasing in enrollment, can I assume then, or can I go on a limb and just guess that some of the Christian colleges are seeing a spike in enrollment?
Well, so I don't have the data
to
substantiate
yeah.
that from the perspective of the research I've done.
You see why I asked that, though. Yeah.
Although I would certainly say, anecdotally, you look at institutions that have large growth in enrollment.
Right.
You know, there are institutions that have specifically, they know who they're trying to serve.
Sure,
okay, and this is true in all cases. You
mm-hmm.
take an institution like Babson, right?
Mm-hmm.
People actually know a lot about Babson. They think entrepreneurship. I mean, it has a bit of a signature.
Mm-hmm.
Most colleges and universities, if you say, like, well, what's the signature of that mm-hmm. education? Or who's their customer? They actually have a hard time answering that mm-hmm. or articulating that.
Does the data that you all gathered give you any sense of whether or not people are hopeful about the future of education versus just being down on it in this moment?
Yeah, so I don't know that we've necessarily asked a lot of questions that get at, you know, what they think about. I'll tell you mm-hmm. this, though, and this comes from data we did as part of a Gallup Lumina poll mm-hmm. that we worked on with Jamie Marisotis,
sure.
was 8 out of 10 U.S. adults believe that higher education must change to adapt to meet the needs of current students,
mm-hmm.
right? So there is a great sense
among
almost all of us, 80%, mm-hmm. Saying higher education needs to do something to cater to, you know, the modern learner. And I think what is built around that is that there are more adult workers going back to college in various
sure.
forms than
mm-hmm.
ever before. If we want to hit those attainment goals, it's going to have to come not just from traditional age students. I mean, literally impossible mm-hmm. for it to come from traditional age students. It's going to have to include adult workers. And you think about the needs of an adult worker, you know, going back to college,
mm-hmm.
whether that's online, hybrid, you know, going back to a physical campus, you know, those are things that are a totally different ballgame. You've got kids, you've got a full-time job. You're, you know, that is a very different story. So there's a lot about higher ed that, you know, the U.S. population feels needs to change. Mm-hmm. And in our research studying college graduates and looking at their success in work and in life, you know, we've identified some really key ingredients of what makes that higher education experience mm-hmm. work. It turns out it's things like whether your professors, you know, knew you as a person, you know, that they actually cared about you mm-hmm. as an individual, whether you had a mentor who encouraged your goals and dreams. But it also includes really practical stuff like, did you have a job or an internship where you applied what you were learning in the classroom? Did you work on a long-term project that took more than a semester to complete? What's crazy about those last two, less than a third of U.S. college graduates strongly agree to either of those. Mm. So you say, okay, you know, are there some real, you know, things to look at in higher education? Yes, there are some structural things that mm-hmm. I think need to be addressed. You look at the lens of, you know, what makes for successful graduates, it's those kinds of things, and that yet the scorecard for higher education is lower than it probably ought to be on those kinds of metrics. Yeah.
Here's the extra question, I think. What do you think, I know you didn't poll this, but do you have any sense of what the political implications are going to be? Because when you start seeing data like this, and it starts impacting, you know, the future of higher ed or post-secondary education in this country, there are going to be some political ramifications at some point.
You know, we've already seen pieces of this, right? The question is, will it be accelerated, right? Will it go in a new and different direction? But mm-hmm. state funding for higher education in many states has been pulled back over the last several years, right? And so in states that have been, you know, more Republican in nature, you know, you can track and look at the fact that, you know, state funding for colleges and universities in those states is down. The question is that going to continue? And that's going to put pressure on, you know, raising tuition. You know, there's a whole bunch of things that go into that. So where you have Republican state legislators who are listening to their constituents saying, you know, this college thing, you know, probably isn't worth it or whatever it might be, right? It's too liberal. It's going to, you know, brainwash my kids. I mean, there's all kinds of, you know, statements that, you know, were analyzed under the hood of those open-ended questions that we asked. But, you know, that's the real question, right? Is it really going to be exacerbated, or are we looking at a time frame here of a couple years where there's been a very fast souring, and is there going to be recovery in, you know, how Republicans feel about higher education? I mean, I think if there's a recovery, it's going to come from seeing more colleges and universities develop practical kinds of degrees and programs, right? And this is the interesting thing. This is not a mutually exclusive conversation, right, of the liberal arts or careerism or the liberal arts mm-hmm. or vocational training. We actually dumb down this conversation by painting that as an either or. Those are not mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. We need to get over that. Those things, that's a both and.
Sure, sure.
And yet we create, you know, a distinction between those two things. And that's part of the problem. Higher ed creates that distinction in that conversation. You know, and I think you're seeing the American public make that distinction because you ask the question, what's the purpose of college? And guess what? When you ask people that, they have many answers.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not singular, but at the top of their list is to get a good job. So that's number one no matter who we ask. Yeah. Parents of 5th through 12th graders, college freshmen as UCLA does in their famous SERP survey. You know, regardless of who you ask the question, the number one reason is get a good job. But underneath that, there's a whole bunch of other reasons why we value it, right? To become well-rounded and an engaged citizen. And, you know, I mean, those are all things that are up there as well. But it's like we treat those as being mutually exclusive. Like, you know, if you go for one, you can't have the other.
Yeah.
I think that's ludicrous.
There you have it, an education on education in our country. Thanks to Brendan Bastide of the Gallup Organization. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Revelations about Harvey Weinstein have led to a national conversation about sexual harassment and assault in the workplace. Gretchen Carlson has spoken out about the issue for some time now. In 2016, she sued the late Fox News Channel chairman and CEO Roger Ailes for sexual harassment. She's now sharing her experiences and insights in a new book called Be Fierce, Stop Harassment and Take Your Power Back. Good to have you on the program. This is the first time in all the years I've known you, I've been on your shows over the years.
Right.
First time having you on our set.
Well, reciprocal, right?
Yeah, yeah, finally.
Thank you so much for having me.
No,
I really appreciate it.
No, I'm honored to have you on. I think a lot of people were just shocked to see that $32 million figure that Mr. O'Reilly apparently, allegedly, according to the New York Times, paid to another Fox analyst. You were an anchor, of course, but another Fox analyst. When you saw that figure, when you saw that story, how did it hit you?
Well, I was horrified that any company would re-sign an employee after that kind of a money settlement, an employee who had been dismissed for those kinds of allegations. I was outraged even more to the same extent that that same person was invited back if those revelations were known. I mean, it's outrageous the lengths at which companies will go to protect harassers and shut up the victims. And it's not just happening in television and Hollywood. What I found out in researching my book is that it's happening everywhere across this country. Sexual harassment is an epidemic for women in all different financial categories and all different professions.
Yeah. I think the part of the story that struck me most, and I've been dying to ask you this, which is what you make of the fact that the network, apparently, according to the New York Times, accepted his retort and that of his attorney that this is a personal matter and that we will handle this. So here are two employees of your network. One is accused of having harassed the other, and you accept from his attorney, this is a private matter, it's a personal matter, we will handle this, and once they get that out of the way, then they go back to the network and say, okay, it's handled. They don't tell the network what the dollar figure was that we now know was $32 million that they settled for, but it's been handled, we've got this, now we can begin negotiations on Mr. O'Reilly's new contract. What did you make of the fact that the company allowed them to handle this as a private matter?
Mm-hmm. Like nothing ever happened, and that women should just be shut up and never heard from ever again.
And that didn't happen in their workplace.
And look at Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
You know, the board there allegedly knew that he was also doing these kinds of activities, and within his new contract, they said, well, we'll basically go ahead and continue to sexually harass women, but if we find out about it, you'll just have to pay us a fine. I mean, what does that say about companies' respect for women in the workplace? It says they don't care at all. And what remains outrageous to me in 2017 is that we're still having this discussion about an epidemic that hasn't been fixed. I mean, we fooled ourselves in our culture, Tavis, over the last couple of decades in thinking that we had resolved this issue. But one of the main reasons why we think that is because so many sexual harassment cases are settled in silence. When you sign a settlement, you're gagged.
It's the NDA, better known as we call it NDA, non-disclosure agreement. Okay.
And also, the other way in which we solve these issues is that prevalent in employee contracts is a clause called forced arbitration. So you basically give up your Seventh Amendment right to any kind of dispute that you might have at work. Trust me, I never expected to have a dispute. Mm-hmm. People don't. But if you do, what you find out in one of your darkest days is that you are not going to an open jury process amongst your peers to have it adjudicated. You're going to a secret chamber called arbitration, and you can never tell anyone what happened to you. And in many cases, you are fired, and the harasser gets to stay on the job. So this is how we are fooling our culture into believing that we've come so far, because we never hear about these cases. But that's why.
So let me be gentle here, but you're a journalist. I know you can handle this. It is obviously legal. Put another way, it is a legal tool, talking now about the NDA. So that when Gretchen or anyone else signs an agreement, they're told when they sign this, here's the amount of money you're going to get, this is what you're going to say, here's what we're going to say, and beyond this, nobody's going to say anything else, and if you do, you're subject to yeah. So you sign this NDA. I understand, because I've been through enough of these contracts myself, I understand why you would sign it, and yet I'm ambivalent about it, because to your own point, it keeps everything quiet. Mm-hmm. It keeps it secret. I don't know how that aids and abets us getting a handle on the issue.
It's a great question.
Yeah.
The only other option people like me have is that they would have been forced into secret arbitration and you would never have heard about my case.
Right.
I mean, had it not been for the legal strategy to make my case public, and by the way, people can go online and read my complaint. Mm-hmm. So it's out there. But you're left with two choices, silence or silence.
Mm-hmm.
That's really where we are right now in the culture. So what accompanies all of this are a lot of myths with regard to this. You know, well, why didn't you come forward sooner? Well, that is a loaded question, because when you're going up against one of the most powerful people in the world, it's an excruciating choice, because how do we still label women? We label them liars, mm-hmm. troublemakers, and worse. They're not to be believed. They just can't take a joke. So who dares to come forward? We had our own president who said that women come forward for money and fame. I've never met anybody who wanted to be famous for this issue.
Mm-hmm.
So there are so many myths that surround it. Here's where I feel so optimistic right now. since I jumped off my own cliff 15 months ago. Right. Look where we are today. We're talking about these horrific headlines, but the positive is that more women are putting their names and their faces to this issue. They are digging deep to find the courage and the bravery to come forward. And to me, this is a tipping point in our society.
Is it courage and is it bravery, to use your words, when scores of women, many of them well known, start coming out to tell their stories after the fact? Mm-hmm. And what each of them says is that it would have, in one way, shape, or form, it would have damaged my career. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sensitive to that. I'm sensitive to it, and I totally get that. Mm-hmm. And I don't tell people how to live their lives, how to make their own decisions, how to make their own judgments. Mm-hmm. But what I think I hear you saying is that you chose your career over being a whistleblower. Mm-hmm. And I'm just not sure that that is the definition of courage and bravery. I'm glad you came out and spoke. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you're on the record. Because you need to know that, and people need to know the story, you know, however they discover it. But is it courage and is it bravery if you come out after the fact rather than making a choice that my principles, my life, my womanhood, my dignity is more important than my career, and I'm going to come out and say this anyway?
Mm-hmm. Well, I did do that.
Yeah, you did. You did. I'm not asking about you. I'm asking, since you raised Harvey Weinstein, I'm asking about whether or not you think it's courageous and brave of other women after the fact. Uh-huh. To then come out and...
I do.
Okay.
Because in my mind, I think that we shouldn't question the timing of when women finally find that courage. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, it's an excruciating choice. Courage building is not something that happens to you overnight, like a light switch.
Sure.
That you just turn on.
Absolutely.
I mean, I read a whole chapter on parenting because I think it actually starts in the way in which we raise our kids, and much more specifically our sons, to respect women in the home so that when they get into the workforce, they respect their female colleagues. So I'm not going to judge women who don't find that courage overnight. I know how hard it is to build. And I had a great foundation as a child with parents who told me I could be anything I wanted to be. And I had a tremendous amount of courage as a kid, was tenacious and brave. But even with me making this most personal decision in my life, it was painful and took a tremendous amount of time. So that's why I'm not going to judge any other women.
How did you process, Gretchen, past the, what I assume at some point had to be bitterness, anger, disappointment? How did you navigate through that part of this 12-step program that you had to go through?
In making the decision?
Yeah, yeah.
To come forward?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, just like you, I've worked so hard my whole life. I had 25 years in the TV business, and when I realized last July that that was going to come to an end for me, at least at that particular place, and that it wasn't my choice, mm-hmm. I had to dig incredibly deep to make the jump. And I had to do it not only for myself, really for all the other women out there that I eventually heard from. That was the impetus for the book. Mm-hmm. I heard from thousands of women, and it was unbelievable to me that it started happening on the first day, from every profession. And here's what they said. Thank you so much for being the voice for the voiceless. And when I went back to them and said, could I share your stories in my book, I thought, about half will say no at least. Yeah. Almost all said, would you please? Because nobody has ever cared about what happened to me. And that's when I felt the additional call of duty, that I had to write this book to give those women a voice and to stop this from happening for future generations. And I really feel in this book like we're celebrating men, too. Mm-hmm. Whole chapter on men. My unscientific study on the streets of New York City, you know who I hear more from? Men than anyone else. When they pass me by, they stop, they shake my hand, and they say, thank you for my daughters. Men out there, the majority of men, want to help women in this mission. It's just these random jerks that we have to get rid of along the way.
And what's our assignment for all the men around the world, around this country?
Thank you.
What's our assignment?
Thank you for asking.
Yeah.
So to be part of the Be Fierce movement, mm-hmm. stop being enablers, because that normalizes the culture. Speak up and stop being a bystander. If you can also find the courage in your heart to stand up for a woman when you see somebody being wronged, and not just a woman,
sure.
any other situation
sure.
in the workplace. If we can do those two things and turn bystanders and enablers into allies, imagine the shift within the corporate culture. I mean, suddenly women would have a man as their ally, and a man can shut it down like that. You hear something, locker room talk, and you say, you know what, I don't approve of that. Don't ever speak like that before me ever again. It's the end of the story, especially when it comes from a man. So men are just as much a part of this movement as women. In fact, what I'd like to say is that the burden of finding a solution to this shouldn't only rest on the shoulders of women. We need men.
You understand, I'm not demonizing anybody either. I'm just asking questions.
I totally get it.
Just trying to guess.
You're asking great questions.
Everybody, I mean, the truth is, I mean, these are uncomfortable questions to ask, and yet the questions I've tried to raise are questions that I hear everywhere I go.
I know.
We're all having, to your point, these conversations, and it just takes a little different kind of energy to raise them. But anyway, her name, of course, is Gretchen Carlson. The book is called Be Fierce, Stop Harassment, and Take Your Power Back. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Danai Gurria is an award-winning actress, playwright, and activist. Her plays include the critically acclaimed Broadway production Eclipsed, which starred Academy Award winner Lupita Nyong'o. On screen, she's best known for her role as Michonne on AMC's The Walking Dead, and she'll appear in the upcoming Marvel film Black Panther. Before we start our conversation, here now a clip from The Walking Dead.
I know you wanted to go with him. I did too.
Everything hurts.
But I'll help you defend this place.
Help me?
Oh, yeah. This is your show. Okay. We'll see.
This is like the most popular show in the world.
I guess.
Yeah.
I'll go with what you're saying. That's amazing. Yeah. That's amazing. You sort of hear that sort of a thing and you're sort of floored by it, but that's amazing.
Yeah, but a chance to be in a show that is celebrated and seen, not just in this country, but as celebrated and as seen around the world is a big deal.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I consistently pinch myself because I stepped into it really from a place of wanting to be a part of something that felt like really rigorous, intense, truthful human storytelling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I write as well. So for me, it was that question of signing, you know, you sign that contract that could be a 7-year thing. You want to make sure it's something that feels right to you. And that's very important to me.
Yeah.
And it just felt so right when I watched from the pilot up until at that point, season 2. It was just the right elements were in place for you to feel really fulfilled as an artist.
And what were those elements for you as an artist?
Well, what was interesting was there was a lot of overlap with who I was as a playwright. Mm-hmm. One of my plays, Eclipsed, mm-hmm. deals with women at war and how they have to respond to a world that completely works out of their favor. In fact, is insanely hostile towards them, mm-hmm. and how they navigate survival. And that felt like so many elements of what was going on in The Walking Dead, like how you navigate survival in a world that's turned against you. And really my character, who I found really fascinating, actually, I was like, who is this woman who has a katana and dreadlocks? And like, mm-hmm. I was like, I've never seen this before.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was so intrigued by her. But she also reminded me of the women I researched, the women I interviewed in Liberia, who had turned into their own weapons of war to combat a war zone that was working against them, but was not of their making.
Yeah.
So there were so many overlaps I found that really connected to what I find important, which is that storytelling of who would you be if the world got this dire?
Yeah.
And really, both the premise of Eclipse and the premise of The Walking Dead were like overlappingly identical in that way.
I'm going to come back, because you're very modest. You're not just a playwright. Your stuff has been Tony nominated, so we'll come back to that in just a second, back to your stage work. But since you've made this parallel, Danai, again, we'll come to your play and the humanity in that. For you, though, where was the humanity play in your role on The Walking Dead? What did you see? What did you discover that?
Well, I mean, the beauty of her was really that, you know, she comes onto the scene and she brings a whole new element to the storytelling. Mm-hmm. We meet Rick and we meet his family and his friends and the people he ends up connecting with. We meet them right at the beginning of this basically end of civilization moment.
Right.
And so we see them take the initial steps into how they're going to navigate this new world. And with her, we meet her after navigation has been happening for a while. So we meet her in her kind of her post-PTSD. Well, she's really in PTSD, mm-hmm. but we're seeing her navigate her PTSD in a way that involves having shut down emotionally, having decided to become her own weapon of war, having, you know, really figured out her own way through without connecting with other people. She's really cut herself off from humanity to protect herself from further loss. So she was just a totally different segment of the experience coming in to people we've been getting to know since the moment things went awry. Yeah. So I found that really, really fascinating, and it allowed for such a stunning journey for her to take as a character, where she kind of has to start reconnecting to her humanity mm-hmm. and facing those fears and the trauma of her past and choosing to navigate into a new future and to fight for one.
Yeah.
And so really piecing those things together and knowing that, you know, she was going to have to go through that journey as a character, but she was going to start off very stoic, very disconnected from being able to communicate or to, share her traumas or to connect with other people again, you know, and really being kind of, she was disarming to so many people because mm-hmm. you couldn't read her, and she wanted it that way. And I found her, she was kind of that person you're like, I don't know if I should mess with this person or talk to this person. It was very interesting to play that because I'm very gregarious and loquacious, and she's not. She wasn't in the beginning, and that was very interesting to navigate.
Let me go back to your playwright work, because we were celebrating you from a distance. Of course, this is in New York, the Tonys. We're out here in L.A., but we were celebrating you when those announcements were made. That had to be stunning for you.
It was amazing. It was very another pinch me, I'm dreaming moment. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, that play's journey was so epic. That was my second play. I was on to my fourth mm-hmm. at that point. But it had started off at I'd created it in 2009, mm-hmm. 2008. And had a really great life in regional theaters. Mm-hmm. And one of the regional theaters we had an original production in was Yale Repertory, mm-hmm. where Lupita was understudying, because their MFA students understudy the characters that go into the repertory. Mm-hmm. So that's how we connected. And I knew her from before, but we connected much more during that process. And I kept trying to use her for my plays, but she was in school. Mm-hmm. So I had my next play, The Convert, and I was like, this is also perfect for you, like, come and how do we strategize to get you out of school to come and do these productions? And I understand it, and as an African myself, you don't step out of school to do that. You get that degree. I knew she was going, we had to see her through to getting the degree, but there are many a time I wanted to pull her out and use her for the work. So she loved the play, and she had a deep connection to it, and it was great, because I female director, all female cast, we just kind of all became very close sisters. And she told me after everything happened when she graduated, everything happened with 12 Years a Slave so fast, but she told me, I really want to go back to the stage with Eclipsed. I want to go back to the stage. And that's kind of how that run of Eclipsed mm-hmm. came to pass. And so, of course, I told them, the producers started to come at me, and I said, not without director Liesl Tommy. She's the director mm-hmm. I trust with the work with this particular play. And she came along, and we got on the ensemble together, and it was amazing because the play had done a lot of regional, but it had never come to New York. Yeah. It was almost like the time had come for it to make it to New York.
And all those sisters, though, on the stage is a beautiful thing to see.
When I went into learning about what was happening with women in war, specifically in mm-hmm. Liberia, a dear teacher gave me Ken Washington, who's now passed, was an amazing man, African American man, who came to teach at Tisch often, mm-hmm. and handed me a newspaper, New York Times. He said, I know you're into these type of stories. And I took it, and I was like, yes, I am. And it was basically the cover of the New York Times at that time was these women who were rebel fighters in Liberia. And I grew up on the continent. You can never call Africa monolithic, because I grew up in the most different part of the continent. when I looked at that, I said, I've never seen anything like this in my life. And I grew up there, like seeing these women who were literally soldiers of war, but rebel soldiers, and decked out, and then they had their AK-47s, and I was like, what is this? Like, my mind was blown. And I knew I had to pursue that story at some point. It actually was 4 years later after my first play that I did. And so going to Liberia and meeting those women and, you know, taking on that story, and asking, really asking their permission if I could tell it in some ways, and sharing with them, this is what I would like to do. But that to me was, it became so clear that we don't hear their stories. Everyone knew who Charles Taylor was. Everyone knows the name of the big bad guy, and you know, and all the those key players who go to the treaties. Mm-hmm. But no one knows the names of the women and the girls who are the casualties of war, whose bodies are used, you know, to fight wars upon. No one ever talks to them about them. And many of those women said to me, no one's ever asked me what happened to me during this time period. And that just became clearer and clearer to me that I was going to remove the male from the stage, mm-hmm. and allow them to be seen and heard, because the title is about that. It's about their light being blocked. But the hope in the title is that an eclipse is always temporary.
Yeah. I got 2 minutes to go. I want to cover two topics if I can very quickly, a minute apiece. First, tell me about your work with these girls, Love Our Girls.
Oh, that is, it's something I created because I am very passionate, yeah. about women and girls and the issues around the world concerning women and girls. And I was born on Valentine's Day. My name means to be in love, in Shauna. And, you know, I really, really wanted to bring about something around Valentine's Day. I always thought Valentine's Day was the most bizarre holiday. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, love needs to go. Everyone's like waiting for their thing. What, yeah. should get me Valentine's Day? What's it going to be? What's it going to be? Rather than, yeah. like, let's let it be love that's going outward. And yeah. The girls around the world need our love and attention. So every month I highlight an organization. I release a newsletter. It's an encouragement to take a pledge and connect to becoming, yeah. aware and spreading awareness. Really, yeah. it's an awareness hub around women and girls.
And lastly, not that you can say much, Chadwick was just here not too long ago.
Yes.
So I can't let you go in the last 45 seconds without just saying two words, Black Panther.
Yeah. Yeah, listen, the most beautiful thing, I mean, it's so many beautiful things about being a part of that.
Yeah.
One of them is I grew up as a little girl on the continent. You grew up as a black boy in the United States. We didn't see this. Mm-hmm. We didn't see black people on that platform being superheroes, taking care of things, you know, having, you know, that sort of resonance. And to be a part of that, to see it, mm-hmm. it's something that I would just have loved to watch it. The fact that I also get to be a part of it, yeah. it's amazing to me.
It's stunning, and I'm glad you're in it. Well, you're doing great work all across the board, so thank you for taking the time to come see us. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.